Jim Davis, great to have you here. Sort of looking back at the session, we had a long session, 8-month session. Now you're in your third term. Was this session any different, and what was your overall take, just sort of looking at it broadly?
Well, it was a little more intense, as you mentioned, it lasted about 2.5 months longer than typical for a long session, but I think we made good use of that time. We had this year, we think largely because of the regulatory and the tax changes that we made, we had a over $400 million surplus, and some people were anxious to spend that money, and the Senate wanted to put it in most of it into savings, which we wound up doing. We increased spending in North Carolina budget just slightly more than inflation and population growth.
Okay. And so as a member of the Senate, were you more in favor of the less spending approach that the Senate was taking rather than the House?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the main reasons why I went there is for fiscal responsibility. I think we owe that to the young people of North Carolina to get our fiscal house in order.
Right. And you were with the one of the major committees, right? The Finance Committee and the Appropriations Committee. Is it possible to sort of pull the curtain back and let us know what those negotiations were like during those 2 months?
Well, the negotiations between the House and the Senate mainly took place with the senior appropriations chairs, and of which I am not one. The Senate was pretty unified in where we stood. We wanted to take I don't believe there is such a thing as a budget surplus. I think it's overtaxation. But nevertheless, our economy is growing by every fiscal measurement that you look at. North Carolina is in better shape than it was in 2011, January 2011, when we took over. And we have recovered faster than the nation at large. And so we think that the changes that we've made had an impact in that. And so we wanted to preserve the little over $400 million and put it into a rainy day fund, which had been depleted prior to our taking office. We were facing a $2.5 billion budget deficit because the rainy day fund did not exist. And there will be another recession in the future. We just don't know when. And so we want to be prepared for it.
Were you happy with the budget agreement that eventually came out? Did you think it was a good compromise?
Absolutely, I think it was. We were pretty close to the governor. We wanted to, we didn't want to spend the money. I think the House wanted to spend about 5%, and I believe we held it to about 2.2% growth.
Why was it that the Senate was slower to go along on certain measures such as JDIG funding, whereas the House sort of went along with Governor McCrory's request really early on? The Senate kind of said, hold on. And the same was true for the bond measure, which passed in the final days. Why was that?
Well, a lot of things maybe are a little different than they appear because of negotiations that are going on in back rooms, having to do with where you're going to spend money and how much. My take on the Senate was always opposed to a bond referendum for road construction, for infrastructure. We believe that we have started. Matter of fact, one of the things that we campaigned on in 2010 when the Republicans took over was to stop the transfer of highway trust fund money from the highway trust fund, which is where it belongs, into the general revenue. And the last year, I think it was about $225 or $30 million. And so we believe that if you take that over a 4 or 5 year time frame, that you'll be able to do the road construction projects out of general revenue money or highway trust fund money, like it was supposed to have been done. Not general revenue, highway trust fund money. And so that's why the taxes that we collect is for that. We think it's important that it's spent for that. And so we didn't need to borrow the money, even though we are at historically low interest rates. We'd rather pay for it as we go than borrow the money.
So, with filing starting on Tuesday, a lot of Republicans leaders in the House and the Senate, Skip Stam, Tom Apodaca, Bob Rucho, have announced that they're not going to run again after the short session. Why do you think that is? And I know a lot of them said that the work that they set out to do has largely been accomplished.
Well, I think I take them at their word. Apodaca's been there since 2002. Rucho has been there about that long. I think he had about a 2 or 4 year hiatus when he went back to practicing dentistry, but then he's been back in the Senate. So they've been there for quite a while. It's a real sacrifice for your family and for you personally to be in the legislature because it's not very lucrative. But all of us knew that before we asked for the job. But I think it's time for them. They felt like they had worked hard to accomplish certain goals, and they have accomplished most of those. And so it was time to step back, and I respect their decision.
Do you think that with Tom Apodaca stepping down, how do you think that's going to affect us in Western North Carolina?
Well, he's a number two guy in the Senate. Tom Apodaca is a powerful force to be reckoned with in the legislature. And there are not many people, in my opinion, that are irreplaceable. But Senator Apodaca comes really close. The responsibilities that he has to decide what legislation is heard, what committees it goes to, it's like a three-dimensional game of chess. And you've got to know when you push over this domino, whichever dominoes are going to fall. And he is masterful at that. And so I was very disappointed. I've contacted him and told him that I respect his decision, but I didn't like it because I really appreciate his public service. He's been there a long time, and like he said in his public statement, he's accomplished a lot of the goals that he set out to do, and so it's time to get on with the rest of his life. And I respect that, and I look forward to that myself.
Now, you're in orthodontics, right?
And that's correct.
A dentist as well. How does it affect you personally when you're at the legislature? Have you still been able to keep your practice going?
Yeah, I still practice a day and a half or 2 days a week. Like I said, the legislative salary is not that great. So if you want to buy groceries, you still have to work. And plus, I enjoy what I do. And in addition to providing some steady income, it allows me to keep in touch with the public and exchange ideas and hear what it's on their mind. So for a lot of reasons, I continue to practice, and I've been at it for 40 years, though. So,
well, in sort of a healthcare field and serving on the healthcare committee, and one of the major accomplishments for Republicans this year was Medicaid reform. How did you think that played out? Were you happy with what resulted from that?
Well, we're part of the way there. We still have a long ways to go. Medicaid is the fastest growing part of our budget, and it's an entitlement, so we don't have much choice in the matter. We just have to fund it, and it's impacting our ability to fund other things like public education, public safety, and public health. So it's occupying a monumental part of our budget, and it's unpredictable. So the senior chairs in the healthcare committee have worked diligently to try to reform Medicaid, and they're not done. And I hope to see some additional changes to be done there. Medicaid program is not a health program; it's an insurance program.
Right.
And we need to focus it more on health outcomes rather than just procedures. And so that's what they're looking towards. Mm-hmm. And I applaud their efforts. It's a monumental, Herculean effort that they are making to try to help reform Medicaid, and they're not done.
As far as Medicaid expansion, I know Governor McCrory has said in the past that if there was a way to sort of craft Medicaid expansion as sort of a in North Carolina's way rather than the federal way, then he would be more open to it. And he also mentioned that he would like to make sure that Medicaid reform got done first. Do you think that we are to the point where the legislature could start considering Medicaid expansion?
I hope not. We need to make sure that the reforms that we're making and the ones that we're still proposing are going to impact the expansion of Medicaid. Frankly, I'm very pessimistic. I'm a realist, but I'm pessimistic with that because it's just a runaway program, and I don't see how it's sustainable. But we'll have to wait and see. Some people say, "Well, go ahead and expand it. The feds are going to pay for it." And you're only going to pay 10% after the third year. And I say 10% of what? And people don't know.
Uh-huh.
It's an incredible obligation for the state, and I'm not willing to go down that road until I know how thick the ice is.
I see. What do you say to the argument that people have made that, you know, we're paying for it anyway? People are already paying for the money that kind of goes out and to the other states that have expanded Medicaid.
Well, it's just too early to tell. Some of them, New Mexico, I think they are looking at $1 billion more than they expected. Connecticut is having the same problem. Arkansas tried their own thing, and it's not working very well there. It's just runaway expenses. And so I'm proud to be among the North Carolina Senate and the legislature that's looking at more Medicaid reform so that we can get a handle on this before we try to expand it. You know, if you can't afford the house you're in, why would you build a bigger one? In a nutshell, that's what these states that are expanding it are doing. They can't afford the program that they have, and just because they're supposed federal dollars out there to spend, they're willing to do that. Well, I pay federal taxes too, and I'm really concerned about the future of our country. We're on some thin ice, I think, physically, and we have to get a handle on this for the younger generation, especially.
One of the issues I know that you've been working on pretty diligently is the Lake Junaluska annexation. Why does that keep getting stalled up, despite what seems to have support from, you know, you, and it seems to be a bipartisan effort? Some of the people that I've talked to, I think it was Joe Sam Queen, have also been working on that and seem to be on board with it. Why is that not getting done?
Well, I'm really not sure, or else I would have been able to get it through. We have some people that have blocked it, and I'm getting sometimes incomplete answers and sometimes dishonest answers. I really don't have a dog in that fight, other than to me it looks like it's an opportunity for self-determination, especially the bill that was introduced that I introduced this session, giving the voters in Lake Junaluska and the voters in Waynesville each side to decide on whether they wanted this annexation to go through. I'm not a resident there, and so, again, I don't have a dog in the fight, but it appeared to me to be a good way of self-determination, and I thought that's what America was all about. But some people have blocked it at certain places, so I really don't have a good answer for you.
Okay. Speaking of, sort of self-determination, some of the things that the legislature did that did rile some people up were taking away the vote for the Greensboro mayor, just making changes to Greensboro City Council, making changes to the Wake County Board of Commissioners. Were you in favor of those changes? And if so, why?
Well, I come from a local government perspective. I still believe, matter of fact, more now than ever, that the local government is the best government. If you are dissatisfied with what's going on at the local level, then you have an opportunity to change it at the local level. However, there are some times when local governments, they abuse their power, and that's been evident in some places. And so I think that it behooves the state government. Again, I come from local government. I was a county commissioner in Macon County for 10 years, and it was very rewarding 10 years. I'm very comfortable with how the government was when I got there and how it was when we left. So I think we did some really good things. But, and again, I believe the local government is the best government. But sometimes the state legislature has to step in when some things are being abused, and to also to ensure that everybody gets representation. If you have a county or a municipality that's dominated by one particular party or one ideology, then the other ones get left behind. And so by dividing municipalities or counties into certain districts, then it allows other people to have a voice. And I think that's what was attempted in those particular situations.
In the case of the Wake County race, I know that it was changed in a way where Democrats had basically swept one election, held they were unanimous on the Board of Commissioners, and it was changed in a way that would have given Republicans a 5-4 advantage had that map been used. Do you think that's fair?
Well, you know, I'm not as up to date on how that was particularly done in Wake County, so I really can't speak to that. But I think the fairest thing to do is from the state perspective is to ensure that everybody has a voice, I'm not a big fan of stacking it one way or another, and I don't care which way that is. Mm-hmm. I happen to be a conservative Republican with a lot of libertarian tendencies, but I think that everybody should have a voice, and where we can help ensure that people have a voice, I think, is where the state ought to be.
So one of the bills that you sponsored was the magistrate's recusal bill. Why did you sponsor that, and are you happy with how it's played out?
You're speaking about the gay marriage issue.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there were, seven counties in the state that approved of the of gay marriage amendment, that disapproved of it. The other counties approved that marriage is between one man and one woman. And what a judge overturned what was and still is actually a constitutional amendment in North Carolina, a judge has overturned that. And so we reacted in the legislature to allow government officials, you know, register of deeds and clerks of court that are doing those kind of ceremonies to opt out of it. Now, they couldn't opt out just out of gay marriages. They had to opt out of marriages totally. They just wouldn't do it. And so we didn't think that they should lose their jobs as a result of a ruling by a judge. And so they would interrupt their career. And so I think that it's only fair if they have religious objections to performing that ceremony, then they just opt out of performing marriages totally. And I don't think it's right for them to opt out just out of gay marriages.
I mean, does that extend also to, you know, it was a judge who overturned North Carolina's Amendment 1, but then it was the Supreme Court who, you know, made gay marriage legal nationwide. So does that, you know, does saying, you know, a judge shouldn't be able to determine that extend to the Supreme Court as well?
Well, I don't really understand your question. If you're saying that should a judge be able to overturn the voice of the people, then I struggle with that. I think that we're dealing with a lot of activist judges in our society.
Including the Supreme Court?
Think so. I think including the Supreme Court, but that's the system that we have. And I think that I love the separation of powers that we have in this constitutional republic. And I think probably it ebbs and flows over time where one particular part of government oversteps its bounds. And the president does sometimes, in my opinion, and the Supreme Court does sometimes, and the legislature does sometimes. And hopefully we have a balance that puts us where we need to be. But I struggle with what they've done, overturning the will of the people.
So, you know, we're talking today. There's been this shooting in California yesterday, coming on the heels of the one at Planned Parenthood. Of course, the Paris attacks as well. Is what, if anything, can be done on the government level to help prevent these things from happening?
Well, I don't think we can ever prevent them. You have people that have maybe the individuals involved in the San Bernardino attack. And California has very strict gun laws, too. And here these individuals reportedly had assault weapons, and they had some bomb-making stuff attached to some remote control cars. And this, I mean, this was a thought-out attack, if you will. But California has some very strict gun laws. I don't think that's the answer. I believe that we need to make sure that people have background checks in order to purchase these armaments. But, you know, criminals are, by definition, don't follow the law. So I don't know how you're going to do that. But I'm not in favor of restricting people's constitutionally guaranteed gun rights.
I think, you know, a lot of people just kind of look at these shootings. They'd say, you know, if it's not gun control, what is it? Because it seems to be that these shootings happen again and again, and really no laws get passed, at least on the federal level.
France has very strict gun laws. Mm-hmm. California has very strict gun laws. You know, the worst mass shooting was in Scandinavia, and they have incredibly strict gun laws. Mm-hmm. So that obviously is not the cure to this problem. We're dealing with people that have radical, you know, ideologies, whether they're religious-based or not. We have people that are just plain crazy and people that are criminals. So I don't know how you can, you know, there are risks with freedom. And so I'm certainly not in favor of trading my freedom for security personally. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting. This kind of brings us around to the response to the Paris attacks, and you know, both Governor McCrory, Roy Cooper, also. So a bipartisan group of politicians have called on the Obama administration to stop sending Syrian refugees until they can find out more about how that is approved and that sort of thing. Are you in favor of that approach? Were you in favor of them saying, like, hold on?
Absolutely. Why not? Mm-hmm. I mean, would you invite somebody into your home to live there and you're responsible for supporting them if you don't know where they come from? I certainly wouldn't. One of the responsibilities, the primary responsibility I have as a legislator is to ensure, to the best of my ability, the safety of the citizens. And for us to let people in that we don't know who they are, where they come from, Syria doesn't exactly have a database that we can check to see who these people are. And I understand that the federal government has an arduous process to process these refugees. It takes 18 to 24 months in order for them to process them. But I am strongly in support of what our governor has done to say, hold on, we don't want to accept these people unless we know who they are. Can you imagine an easier way for somebody that's dedicated to do us harm to come in, you know, posing as a refugee? So, I mean, our nation has a history of welcoming the oppressed in it within our borders and accepting them as future citizens. And I'm all in favor of that. But we need to be very careful, especially in this day and time, who we let in.
President Obama said very similar to what you had said as far as, you know, freedom has risks by saying, you know, we don't want to give up our values in the process of responding to a terrorist threat. And many people, you know, President Obama himself and many people writing columns around the state I've seen have sort of made that same argument as far as allowing refugees. And what would you say to that?
Well, I think we need to be very careful. But I think we, those people that are oppressed, we should welcome them and offer them a better way. But we need to know who's coming into our country. That's why we need to have secure borders, in my opinion. And I applaud the generosity of the American people. But we would be foolish, extremely foolish, to let people in that are here just to do us harm. And so we have to, I agree with that. I mean, Dianne Feinstein, you know, in California pretty well supports what McCrory's doing. And there are some Democrats, prominent Democrats, that are doing the same thing and instead of many Republicans. And so some people have tried to make this a partisan issue, and I think it's a public safety issue.
I don't think you can answer this because I don't think anybody can answer this, but how do you attempt to sort of get through that partisan divide that can really take form really quickly on issues where, you know, there's a lot of emotion involved like that?
Well, I don't know. It's, you know, we live in a very hyper-partisan time, and I don't relish that. I think that reasonable people can sit down even when you disagree and come to a good place. So I've never been one to criticize. My father was a conservative Democrat, and so I'd be crazy as a Republican to badmouth Democrats because Democrats, I don't consider them to be my enemy. They have a different ideology in some cases. In some cases, they don't. Some of the old-time Democrats are very conservative, such as I am. So we, by name calling, it just really doesn't move the ball forward. I think we need to come together, and reasonable people can come to a reasonable place. And so this hyper-partisan atmosphere is not healthy for our country.
I believe the Senate, the U.S. Senate, today is voting on defunding Planned Parenthood. You know, really a few days after that group, I think. I'm not sure if it has come out if they were actively targeted by that gunman or not, but he was firing at this Planned Parenthood clinic. And the North Carolina legislature took a number of steps regarding abortion and also regarding Planned Parenthood, specifically the one dealing with fetal body part sales and also the waiting period, the 72-hour waiting period. So you describe yourself as a conservative Republican, so I would assume that you would agree to sort of, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to sort of do everything you can to limit abortion. Would that be correct?
Well, I can remember Bill Clinton say that he thinks abortion should be legal but rare. And I have to say that I'm sort of in that camp. But I don't think abortion should be used as a form of birth control. And I hear a lot of women saying that, well, you know, why do men want to control my body? Well, I would say to women, if you have an unplanned pregnancy, you're not doing a very good job yourself. And so that's not my goal, is not to control their body, but I think that the life is very precious, and I think it ought to be, I think it's sanctified. And so I believe that we need to be very careful about how we treat life, and I'm just really concerned when, in some cases, abortion is just a form of birth control. Mm-hmm. And selling, you know, late-term abortion, I think personally is barbaric, and selling body parts is just as barbaric. I don't think that is very complimentary of our society that we're doing that. So that part of Planned Parenthood, I reject. You know, the part that when they're teaching birth control and doing prenatal counseling and things like that, I don't have a problem with that. But the selling body parts is really problematic for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, but they're not selling body parts in North Carolina. So in essence, you know, our legislature took action on something that wasn't taking place in our state.
Well, I don't know that that's true. I'll take your word for it. I don't know. But we wanted to make sure it doesn't happen here. It's happening somewhere. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to take a stand and say that it's not in my state.
Mm-hmm. Well, so this is, as I understand it, is that in some states, I believe California, maybe a couple of others, they can donate fetal tissue, but they can't make money off it. They can't profit off it or sell that fetal tissue. And according to Planned Parenthood, president and their spokespeople, they don't. So, I mean, does that change it at all? What fetal tissue for medical research, is that unethical?
Not in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people would disagree with me, but I not in my opinion, it's not unethical if you want to devote fetal tissue. You know, for any kind of research that we have, but we shouldn't be selling tissues. I mean, you and I can't sell our body parts. If we wanted to sell a kidney out there, we can't do that. That's against the law.
Right.
And we need to really strongly evaluate the ethical concerns that this particular issue brings up. So that's what I'm saying. I want to be very cautious about it, but I'm totally opposed to late-term abortion. And again, I think it's barbaric. And the more that occurs in our society, I think the less sanctity life has. And that's I don't want to be part of that country.
Do you think there will be any more legislation dealing with abortion, or do you think that the steps that the legislature has taken, including the 72-hour wait period and some of the other things that they've done regarding abortion, are enough?
For some people, they're probably not enough. I'm comfortable with what we've done. And I guess we always have to react to, you know, who would have thought, you know, when I was, you know, 50 years ago when I was in high school, who would have ever thought that we were going to be selling baby parts in America, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we have to react to reality, but I don't see any big move in the legislature to expand what we've done with regards to abortion.
Talking about the environment a little bit, what do you think of how the legislature did on the environment? I know that you sponsored this renewable energy safe harbor bill, which extended solar credits for another year for projects that were already in completion. So were you in favor of that and also expansion of solar credits, or were you comfortable letting them sunset?
Oh, I'm absolutely comfortable with letting them sunset. Actually, what I think we're looking at around a $25 or $26 million tax credits that we've given to the solar industry, and most of those tax credits go to two corporations. And most of the energy, people don't understand, most of the energy is generated in northeast North Carolina, and so it doesn't even benefit North Carolina residents. It's going to Virginia and then points north as part of the Dominion power network. Mm. So we're not even getting the power, and yet we're paying for the tax credits. So I think we have to, you know, I'm a strong proponent of of a broad spectrum of energy production, you know, hydro and nuclear, you know, solar, wind, fossil fuel. You know, I worked hard to help give some job modification grants to Evergreen in Haywood County so that they could switch from coal generated power to natural gas, and natural gas is far cleaner than coal. And so I'm a strong proponent of ensuring to the best we can to clean up our environment. But we have to be, what is the cost-benefit analysis of all these things? And if we're giving tax credits to solar farms that are selling their power, or the power is going to not even to North Carolina, and yet North Carolina is paying for it with tax credits, I don't think that's a very smart way to go.
Now, I know the legislature did devote some money towards almost sort of like incentives, almost like luring companies to explore fracking in this state. Do you think that is okay also?
Absolutely. Why not?
Well, it's the same principle as you're talking of, sort of giving an incentive to a company. So like, if you don't like incentives to solar companies, why is it okay for incentives for a fracking company?
Well, I don't know. What incentives are you talking about with fracking company? I thought, you know, if you want to talk about if fracking is good for North Carolina, I believe it is. I helped, you know, I voted for it. And I think it's there are no proven water well contamination from fracking that I'm aware of. It happens in shale rock, and there's no shale rock in western North Carolina. You know, you go down below, you know, probably 2,000 feet, and then you go laterally to harvest this natural gas. And so the water that's down there is not potable water anyway. But the environmental and the property protections that we put in the legislation in North Carolina are the strictest in the country. And so I'm really comfortable with those. And it just so happens that they just recently, within the last month, found a pretty good deposit of shale gas around the Pinehurst area. That's wet gas, which is the best kind. So I think that it has the potential to bring thousands of jobs and millions of dollars of economic progress to our state, and millions of dollars of revenue as well, to tax revenue. So I'm really pleased with that. I don't think that we should give their business any special treatment that we wouldn't do any other one.
What about the issue of local control that we were talking about? And some of these communities have voted to not allow fracking, but the legislature, with their technical corrections bill, basically banned cities and towns from adopting any sort of anti-fracking measures. I mean, should those towns be able to decide whether or not the drilling that takes place on their land is okay?
Well, when you're looking at that, do these communities have the resources to ensure that any fracking is done safely? And I would say that the state has the resources to do that. Local governments do not. In addition to that, you have to understand that North Carolina is a Dillon's Rule state, which basically says the local government can't do anything that the state government doesn't allow them to do. Mm-hmm. Now, I find that that was a real problem for me as a county commissioner. When I found that out, I went to orientation and found out that had never heard of Dillon's Rule. But that's, you know, if the legislature decided to take away Asheville's charter, they could do that. I don't anticipate that's ever going to happen, but they have the power to do that. Towns and counties exist through the grace of the legislature. But having said that, I'm a strong proponent of local control, but we can't have all different municipalities and counties in the state having different rules and regulations with regards to these kind of issues. And so companies have to have sort of a baseline on what to expect from the state. And I think that should a county be able to ban that if you are a property owner and you're sitting on 400 acres that you inherited from your grandpa and they find natural gas there, and the county says that you're not allowed to access that natural gas, and it could mean millions of dollars to your family. Do they have the right to do that? Well, I have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. So long as it can be done safely, and it can be, and it is being done safely.
Right. Interesting, because it's like, you know, on some level, some people will say that the state's controlling what I'm doing. Some people on the very, you know, on their land will say the county's controlling what I'm doing. Other people will say the state's, it's just complicated. And
well, it's, yeah, I would agree. It's, they're not simple solutions, and it's always a balancing act of what governments can do.
Well, let's talk about education a little bit. The House wanted to give raises to teachers. The Senate wanted to do away with funding for teachers' assistance, and that was a, you know, sort of a negotiating piece. And the House basically restored funding for teachers' assistance with the Senate's approval. What did you think about that, and how do you think we're doing as far as funding education, both the K through 12 levels and pre-K, and the university level?
Well, I would say, first of all, my premise is that money is not the answer to all of our education problems, and that seems to be the MO of past legislatures and the educational system saying that in order to fix this, we've got to have more money. I don't think money is the answer to everything. Having said that, the Republican legislature, since it's taken over in January 2011, has increased state funding of K through 12 education significantly. I think we spend about $1.5 billion more for education now than we did when we took over. And so you hear, and then during the campaign, you hear a lot about the fact that we cut education funding. We did not K through 12. And we may have cut it a little bit in the university system and in the community college system, but now that's been more than restored. And so we spend a lot of money. About 57% of our budget is on education totally. 37% is K through 12. So where the Senate is and where the legislature is, I think, is that we want to make sure that we're getting good value for the money that we spend. And we have found that that's not always the case. And teachers' assistance is an interesting part of that. The Senate was in favor of keeping teachers' assistance for K through 2, even 3 in some cases, because the research that we have seen shows that that's where it does the most good. But I will say that there are, for example, I think that a local school system, a local LEA, should be given the flexibility to use the money for teachers' assistance in other grades as well. For example, you know, I was, more than one time, I was part of a class of some really rabble-rousers when I was in elementary school. Some classes are really easy. You can talk to the teachers, and this particular class was easy, and this one was really a bunch of hellions. And so those are where the teacher's assistants need to be. So if we can allow the local educational authority to target those teacher's assistants or the extra help in those problematic classes, then I think that's the way it ought to go. But a lot of the teacher's assistant money, I think around $80 million per year of teacher's assistant money that was part of the budget, was used for other things. So the Senate's position was mainly, if you're going to have the money for teacher's assistance, and it's in the budget for teacher's assistance, use it for teacher's assistance. But that's not what was happening. And so it's kind of truth in advertising, truth in budgeting. We wanted to make sure that the money that was budgeted for teachers' assistance was used for teachers' assistance, and that wasn't always the case.
I know the bond package will include a lot of funding if it passes for universities on for buildings and new facilities and things like that. Are you hopeful that passes?
Oh, absolutely. Again, I think that we are in a unique time, historically low interest rates. We're looking at a $2 billion bond package. I think about $980 million of that is going to be for the university system. $110 million is going to be for Western Carolina University. UNCA does not get as much. I forgot what they get out of that because that's not in my district, and so I didn't pay attention to that. But our community colleges out west are going to reap some of that money as well. But the big thing is a science building at Western Carolina University. It's a $110 million project, and it's been needed. That building was obsolete when it was built, 50 years ago. So I was really glad. Or maybe 40 years ago, I was really glad that we were able to do that. And I'm a strong supporter of that bond package. I think it's the thing to do, and to continue to invest in that. The $2 billion is going to go, $980 for the university system, community college, water and sewer grants, are going to be part of that. National Guard facilities are going to get some of that bond money. So I think that it's a wise investment to spend that money where we have allocated it to go.
So the UNC Board of Governors process for terminating Tom Ross and hiring Margaret Spellings was pretty messy, it seemed like. There was a lot of infighting, it sounded like, and there were allegations even from some board members that the process was too secretive. What did you think about that whole thing?
All I know about that is what I read in the paper where I heard on the news. So I really, that was happening when we were trying to wrap up the legislative session, and so I really didn't pay much attention to that. Maybe I should have, but that was the Board of Governors' responsibility, and if it was not done clearly, and you know, if there was not a lot of light shown on the process, then that's a flawed process, and so I don't like that. But I really can't speak much to that. Like I said, we had our hands full in trying to wrap up the legislative session.
Sure. Did you think the hiring of Margaret Spellings was a good hire, at least from your perspective that you know of?
Well, she has good credentials, and so I certainly hope so. But I really can't speak to that very well, not intelligibly.
Mm-hmm. When we were talking about the budget, I was going to bring up, and I forgot, the sales taxes, the new sales taxes that were included on services and the way that they are distributed. I was wondering, you know, you represent a lot of counties. I think it's like six counties?
Seven.
Seven counties. How did your counties do as far as the distribution of sales taxes? Did they come out ahead?
All my counties came out ahead except for two, and unfortunately one of them was my home county, and Jackson County and Macon County are losers. I think Macon County is going to lose about $100,000 in tax revenue, and I fought the battle, and you know, when that was, the numbers were being massaged to try to be fair to everybody, and I lost part of that battle, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been. But the five counties were net gainers. And what that does is the redistribution of the sales tax revenue is it allows the money to follow the population. The people that are spending the money are the ones where the tax revenue is going to benefit them. We have some really poor counties in this state, and most of them are in the eastern part of the state where they have an incredible high tax rate, and they're just not able to build schools and things like that, that, you know, essential functions of government they're not able to do without an unbelievably high tax rate, ad valorem property tax rate. So I think this is going to help a lot of those counties and shopping centers like Asheville and Charlotte and other areas. They're not going to be able to keep as much of that sales tax revenue. It's going to be less point of sale and more population driven. And I applaud that effort. Even though a couple of my counties were impacted negatively, largely because they're tourist destinations, so they have a lot of people coming there to spend money, but they're not residents.
Someone representing seven counties, do you know, is that the most?
No, there's one in the eastern part of the state. District 1 actually has eight counties.
Oh, I see.
Other than that, I have seven. Of course, my joke is if I flatten mine out, mine would be bigger.
Yeah.
But no, I have. Bill Cook has eight counties, and I'm the next with seven.
Well, you may be pretty unique then in having this perspective where you had winners and losers in your representative area. What were you hearing? Were you hearing a lot from people in all of these counties when that particular discussion was taking place?
Some of the county government people were contacting me because they look at the numbers and they know how to interpret what's going on at the legislature. They keep an eye on things down there. And so I was hearing from some of those. But from the average citizen, no, they don't follow it that closely. And plus, they wouldn't, for the most part, they wouldn't know how to interpret those numbers. You know, they don't know what an Article 44 sales tax is unless they're in county government, for example.
Mm-hmm. What would you say were the issues that got your constituents the most fired up that you heard the most from? I was wondering if people were more engaged or less engaged this session. I couldn't really read it from my perspective.
I wouldn't say that they are more or less, about the same. I get a lot of, you know, sometimes I'll get over 100 emails a day and sometimes I don't. And so we just try to deal with that. I get some phone calls. People call me about issues that they have. But I didn't find this session any particularly different from the other two that I've been part of.
So as at, you know, at, you are running again, and we have the short session coming up. Is there anything that you're hoping to accomplish specifically in this coming short session in April?
Well, I think we need to continue Medicaid reform, because again, that's the biggest unknown in our budget. We have less control over that than anything. It's not predictable, and so we have to get a handle on that if we're going to get some financial, you know, some fiscal stability to our state. And so main that and look, making any budget adjustments. I understand that we're about $20 or $30 million above our projections for our revenue this year, and so it appears as though the changes that we've made are starting to bear fruit, and we're coming back as a state, and so I feel good about that. So maybe it's time in this short session to just sort of sit back and not try to be too aggressive, and just sort of do some fine tuning in our budget and continue regulatory and tax reform, doing those kind of things. But probably no heavy lifting in the short session.
You mentioned we're living in a really partisan time. What's that like at the legislature? Are they good working relationships you have with Democrats in the legislature and even with members of your own party? I'm kind of wondering, like, personally how it is over there.
I have good friends on both sides of the aisle, and there are snakes in both parties, and the key is to learn who they are.
Who are those people?
Yeah. I won't mention any names.
I'd love that.
Yeah. But, you know, there are people that I have good friends that are, you know, there are some people in the legislature, and I found this in a county commission as well, that when they speak, especially when you disagree with them, but when they say something, it always causes you to pause and reevaluate where you are on a particular issue. But the debate in the Senate is very respectful, and I have you know, dear friends that are not in my party, but that's just life. Just because you're in the legislature, people look in the news and, you know, think that people are down there fighting and things, and that's just not the case. We have a very civil debate, and I really love that part of America, that we can debate issues, even very hyper-partisan issues. We can have a strong debate and come to a decision and then go with it.
Well, we've talked for a good while, Senator Davis. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you hope to talk about, or anything from the session or the upcoming or anything like that?
Not really. I think you've done your homework and covered things pretty well. So from my perspective, it's been a good ride. I've been honored to serve the citizens of the 50th District, and I'm hoping to do it for another round.
All right. Well, great. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate you coming in, driving all the way over here.
Yeah, my pleasure.